So we normally do a few things at the regular Bhakti Riksha group that we're not going to do because it's different tonight. But there are some things we're going to do that are similar, and one of them is discuss Bhagavad Gita. And while everyone's looking for the right page, what's the right page? Just say the right page so everybody can open the right page. We're discussing introduction of Bhagavad Gita. So it's somewhere in that section.
Page 8, last paragraph.
While you're getting your book, if you open to the introduction page, you know, authors of books, or a dedication page rather, dedicated to their mother, or some professor they studied under, or some luminary that inspired their work. They're shy, they don't want to come forward.
Veda, come forward.
Could you come forward, you girls? How about this?
Very good, very good.
Thank you. You all look so intelligent. Giggly, too. Okay, enough giggling. Get intelligent now instead of giggling. Okay. A little history behind this particular Bhagavad Gita. When our founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada was still in India, before he had come to America, he received an instruction, the very first instruction and the very last instruction that he got from his spiritual master, a famous exchange, both of them. Literally days before Bhaktisiddhanta left this world, as a householder, Prabhupada had written to his spiritual master saying, "I'm a householder, and you have a number of very brilliant, fully dedicated sannyas disciples. I'm not so fortunate to be able to render some direct service to you as they are able to do, but I would like to serve you in some personal way. What service can I do for you?" Imagine writing such a letter. And Bhaktisiddhanta wrote back, maybe 3 days before he left this world, it was a letter sent, where he requested the same thing he requested the very first meeting, that the teachings of Lord Chaitanya are very deep and profound, and he desired that in every town and village of the world that the holy name of the Lord should be chanted and that his message should be understood. So please go to the, take this message of Lord Chaitanya to the English-speaking parts of the world. For by doing so, it will be both good for you and good for them. Something to that effect. It's not verbatim. And then he left this world, so Prabhupada understood, I asked for it, I got the instruction, so now I have this instruction to carry out. And feeling very humble, what is my qualification to do this? But at the same time, with that humility, feeling the weight of the instruction, he began preparing himself. One of the things was he went to stay in Vrindavan and deeply immerse himself in devotion to Krishna, which was the message of Lord Chaitanya. And among the many things that he did, he prepared a commentary on Bhagavad Gita. Now he had, while still in India, published 3 volumes of Canto 1, Srimad Bhagavatam. So that he had. Hardcover, on, you know, very ancient technology kind of printing presses from India. 3 volumes of Canto 1, Srimad Bhagavatam in a manuscript for Bhagavad Gita, which he had planned to publish. So when he came to America, he began teaching the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, which he had copies of. And a great calamity happened. Someone broke into the place where he was staying in New York City, stole his typewriter, which was a manual, not electric typewriter. You know, one of those those kind typewriters. Stole the typewriter, stole the manuscript, so he had to redo the manuscript while still in America. And he writes that an inquisitive American woman asked, Swamiji, can you recommend a translation of Bhagavad Gita for me to read? And he reflected that really I couldn't recommend a particular translation for him to read, because generally the commentaries made available at the time in America were scholars who, by their power of speculation, were producing explanations of Bhagavad Gita which was different than Bhagavad Gita. No, Krishna says this and he means that. And he gave examples. I won't do that just now. But so he prepared yet another commentary on Bhagavad Gita following the commentary of previous acharyas, because the message of Bhagavad Gita teaches that that's how one is to understand the message of Bhagavad Gita. In the 4th chapter, verse 1, the first 3 verses, actually, Krishna explains the process that he recommended for Arjuna and for us to understand, which is the process of disciplic succession. Imam vivasvate yogam proktavan aham avyayam. I spoke this knowledge long ago to the sun god Vivaswan. And Manu, Vivaswan spoke it to his son, Manu. Manu spoke it to his son, Ikshvaku. In this way, the knowledge was transmitted through the process of disciplic succession. And then Krishna goes on to say, after time, the disciplic succession was broken, and so the knowledge was lost. So without disciplic succession, knowledge is lost. You can be a scholar and translate, let's say, you know, we'll become scholar of the scholarly team. The 3 of us will become scholarly team. We'll become PhDs in Sanskrit and do a translation of Bhagavad Gita and agree together this is the message of Bhagavad Gita, just based on scholarship. Well, the message of Bhagavad Gita cannot be entered into by scholarship. It's entered into by receiving in disciplic succession. It's descending knowledge, it's not ascending knowledge. So when Prabhupada made his 2nd commentary on Srimad Bhagavad Gita, he relied on the commentaries of the previous acharyas who had followed that system of disciplic succession. And chief amongst them was, as our dedication page says, Baladev Vidyabhushan. Baladev Vidyabhushan lived in the later 1800s, not so long ago. But he was such a prominent personality in our disciplic succession that he was called upon, there's a historical event, he was called upon to write a commentary following the line of Lord Chaitanya's teaching, commentary on Vedanta Sutra. You want to write a book? That's a challenge. Want to write a commentary? That's a challenge. Write a commentary on Vedanta Sutra? It's like you can't find more of a challenge than that one. Along the line of the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, who existed several hundred years prior to that. So he was brilliant, in other words. And he made a commentary on Bhagavad Gita, which Prabhupada is dedicating his Bhagavad Gita as it is to Baladev Vidyabhusan. And in the introduction to Bhagavad Gita, there's reference to Baladev Vidyabhusan's message that the subjects of Bhagavad Gita are five, and if one can understand these five, you can understand the whole of Bhagavad Gita. So what you've been doing in one of these Bhaktivriksha groups is reviewing what those five are and hearing what Prabhupada says in his introduction, what those five are. So for those of you that have been around a little bit, just for edification and refresh, could you name one of those five topics of Bhagavad Gita? I don't know which one you read so far, so just did they have to be in order? One of the five topics of the five topics of Bhagavad Gita. Chaturupa, what's one of them?
Ishvara.
Huh?
Ishvara.
Ishvara. What does Ishvara mean? Any of the children? Okay. But when I ask for the next ones, you can't do that. But if the Ishvara means?
Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ishvara, literally, it means controller. That's when you're enthusiastic about controller. Controller. Ishvara, or God, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's one of the five topics that's discussed in Bhagavad Gita. Then another one. What's another one?
Jiva or soul.
Jiva or soul. So that's another topic. God and the living entity. Prakriti, material nature. Kala, time. And number five?
Karma.
Karma. So, you said it? Karma? No? What does karma mean? I'm asking her. I couldn't hear.
You're a little
action.
Reaction.
Action and reaction, both, right? Action and reaction. Activity and, according to the laws of nature, the reaction that's due to me or to anyone from the actions that are done. Action, reaction. It's both. So, Ishvara, Jiva, Prakriti, Kala, Karma. Those are the five topics. And woven together in different ways, and Prabhupada used the phrase permutations and combinations in different manner, those five topics constitute the message of Bhagavad Gita, and by understanding properly those five topics, one has the capacity to understand Bhagavad Gita. That's a simple form, and then the skeleton, and then the body is hanging on the skeleton. The text of Bhagavad Gita. So first comes the introduction, and we're reading at the bottom of page 8. Looks like the paragraph above, Ishvara and the jivas have been discussed to some degree, and now comes material nature and Prabhupada is describing in this middle paragraph what is material nature, that there's both spirit and matter are prakriti, living entity is Prakriti, and there's inferior Prakriti. There's superior, Apareyam Atvastranyam Prakriti Midi Vaipram, 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. There's superior nature. And nature means that which is to be enjoyed, and that's us. We're to be enjoyed. Only we like it a different way. We don't want to be enjoyed, we want to be the enjoyer. We want to be Purusha instead of Prakriti. But we're Prakriti. And that's the root of our problem. The problem that brings all other problems. Then the material nature, what would be the paragraph? Material nature itself material nature is constituted by three qualities. Modes of nature, good, dispassion, and ignorance. Above these modes there is eternal time. And by a combination of these modes of nature and under the control and purview of eternal time, there are activities which are called karma. These activities are being carried out from time immemorial, and we are suffering or enjoying the fruits of our activities. For instance, suppose I am a businessman and have worked very hard with intelligence and have amassed a great bank balance, then I am an enjoyer. But then, say, I've lost all my money in business, then I'm a sufferer. Similarly, in every field of life, we enjoy the results of our work, or we suffer the results. This is called karma. So what did Prabhupada just say? Go right ahead.
That if you're a businessman, you're really rich, but...
But?
But then suppose if you say you're poor, then...
And then you're not rich.
You're
a sufferer.
You're suffering, and then that's called karma.
Okay. Well... Okay, thank you. There's ingredients in five topics. Four are eternal and one is temporary. And the one that's temporary is caused by the ones that are eternal. Because the eternal aren't caused, they're eternal. God is eternal, living entity is eternal, material nature is eternal, and time is eternal. And the combination of those create the thing that's temporary. And that's karma. And we come to the material world because we have an intention. And our intention is, I want to change my category from being Prakriti to Purusha. I want to be the enjoyer. And the way that I see that I can be the enjoyer is through fruit of activity. So here I go. Take birth and engage in fruit of activity. Get a material body that I identify with. This is mine. Not only this is mine, this is me. And off I go. Trying to, with the best of my intelligence, trying to make a good plan for enjoyment. And that's fruitive intention or fruitive activity. Now there's another kind of activity that the same living entity can engage in, and that's the activity where there's no reaction for that activity. Karma-free activity or reaction-free activity. That's a topic that's discussed in Bhagavad Gita. And Krishna, when introducing that topic, he says, It's a very difficult topic to understand. Most people don't understand it. Even scholars don't understand it. Now I'm going to explain it, and he explains it, which is an essential message of Bhagavad Gita, the message of devotion. Working, we'll say it in the negative, and then we'll say it in the positive, working without attachment to the fruits of your work. Fruitive work is working with attachment to the fruits of your work, because I want to be Purusha. So I do work so I can get some results so that I can be the enjoyer of the results. That's my Purusha program. Or imitation Purusha, at least. Because the real Purusha is Ishwar. It's really simple. I mean, philosophically it's very simple. That which is the source of everything is the enjoyer of that which the source is the source of. So if I'm the source of my work, then I'm the enjoyer of my work. Real simple. It's proprietorship. So we'll go to Ishopanishad. That's another text that, in course of time, all of you will become familiar with. Prabhupada translated it for a reason. It's about proprietorship. It's a science, a spiritual science of proprietorship. And the essence is, the source of everything is the proprietor of everything. Om Purnama Dak Purnamidam Purnat Purnam Udachyate Purnasya Purnam Adaya Purnam Eva Vasishyate. And even if one doesn't know Sanskrit, that word Purna must be really important. It's said so many times. And Om is the source. It's the absolute truth is the source of everything, and those everythings that emanate their Purnam, they're complete in themselves. And although that original Purnam produces so many Purnams, it remains Purnam. 1 minus 1 equals 1. Don't answer that in your math class. But spiritual science is 1 minus 1 equals 1. He's the complete whole, that's Purnam. And from him so many complete units emanate, and he remains the complete balance, even so many units have come from him. Prabhupada gives this very simple example. Here's a sheet of paper, and you take the sheet of paper and rip it into small pieces and hold it in your hand, and like a child, just throw it off in the room, and all the little pieces go flying in all directions. Now, the original piece of paper is gone because it got divided into little pieces. And each of those little pieces is not the whole piece of paper that you started with, and the whole piece is now gone. So by material comparison, the source should now become zero because it's been distributed everywhere. But the spiritual science is the complete whole is so complete that although so many complete units emanate, from it remains complete. Say it the same way, same thing in a different way. Try to think of, and the answer is you can't, try to think of something that's so big that you take away something from that something that's so big, and it's not changed. It's still as big as it was before you took that something away. And the answer is, there isn't something like that. At least the mind can't think of something like that. It's bigger than the mind can think. And that's the source of everything, is that big. It's Purnam. Otherwise, it's not Purnam. It's something else. It's something not complete. So, because the absolute truth, by Vedanta, the absolute truth is that from which everything comes. Janmad yasya yataha, Vedanta Sutra. Janmad yasya yataha. Baladev commented on that first aphorism. It's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. the source of everything. And because he's the source of everything, he's the proprietor of everything, including us. Because we're part of everything. We're not everything, we're part of everything. And so he's the proprietor of us. We're to be enjoyed by him. We're Prakriti of the Purusha. And then each one of the little units that are emanate from the complete whole, each are complete in themselves, and there's a complete arrangement for their maintenance. That which we require is being provided. And recognizing what we accept, what's been provided from the source of emanation, we're being taken care of. There's another Shruti mantra that Prabhupada would often refer to, and it indicates that all living entities are maintained by one living entity. And Nityo Nityanam, Chaitanas Chaitananam, Eko Bahunam, Yovidadati Kaman. Kaman, the things that we need and we desire, it's being taken care of by one. And to think otherwise, well, that's illusion. And when you're illusion, you get misery. We don't like misery, but we like enjoyment. But so real enjoyment is recognizing who that Eka is, who the Ishwara is, who the Purusha is. And accept, according to Ishopanishad, accept those things that are meant for us as our necessities, our quota. Like it's Prabhupada calls it spiritual communism. Because isms, philosophical or political isms, have a lot to do with proprietorship, isn't it? Communism has says what it says. Everything belongs to the state. And capitalism says what it says. Everything belongs to the guy that got some money, the capitalist. And the totalitarian government says the guy that holds the power, that's it. You don't agree, it's, you're dead. Real simple. And different isms have to do with proprietorship. So this is spiritual proprietorship. Cleverly, Prabhupada calls it spiritual communism. Everything belongs to Ishwara. And then part of what belongs to Ishwara is the living entity. That we're going to go through the factors, the five factors. There's Ishwara. Everything belongs to him. And there's the living entity. The living entity is part of what belongs to him. And material nature is part of what belongs to him. And time is, according to Bhagavad Gita, not different than him also. Time I am, destroyer of all things. Kalos me. I read this once, I don't know if it's true, but the gentleman that produced the first American atomic bomb, and when the first atomic bomb exploded, his name was Oppenheimer, he quoted Bhagavad Gita when he saw the atomic bomb explode. Kalos me. Time I am, the destroyer of all things. So even he knew it wasn't him that destroyed the atomic bomb. It's God through his time energy, because the time energy both brings things into being and takes things out of being. Just read that this morning in the Bhagavatam class. Time has the capacity to infinitely dissolve everything that exists, whatever comes into being, in course of time, to the finest degree of dissolving, all things are withdrawn by time, over time. So, but material nature still exists. It just doesn't exist necessarily in this form or that form or the next form, just like this body. Or this table, or the house, or anything you can think of. Let's do the table. There was something before it was a table. Now it's, you know, it has a function. It's holding some articles on the tabletop. It's a nice table. But before it was a table, it was a tree. And before it was a tree, it was earth. And the seed of the tree. And then, you know, before that it was something else, and before that something else. And then after it's a table, it's going to be something else, and something else, and something else. So the energy is permanent, but the form is temporary. And the form has to do with the desires of the living entity to enjoy. So I do fruitive activity and make a table, or I work and get some money and buy a table, or whatever the bartering system is, if I want a table. But the energy is from God. So that's this fifth factor, karma, activity. And overall, the message of Bhagavad Gita is how to deal with activity. Because how you deal with activity determines your destination in this life and after this life. How you regard work and how you regard the fruits of work. The teaching of Bhagavad Gita is the ability to work comes from Krishna, that the fruits of the work belong to Krishna. And so we should just recognize that, just essentially change the consciousness behind our work and fix our consciousness upon the Supreme and work in a spirit of devotion to the Supreme. And with that spirit of devotion comes detachment. Not the detachment that says, I don't care, but the detachment from the false sense of proprietorship. It's a big one. But there is a real proprietor. Here's some evidence. We enter the world owning nothing. And we leave the world owning nothing. And in between, we're very busy trying to make things ours in different ways. And then we become sufferers. Or, theoretically at least, enjoyers. Sufferers or enjoyers. And that's karma. So the concept of work, or the concept of activity, acting in the world, and so the concepts as people study Bhagavad Gita and try to live Bhagavad Gita, there's different ways of how we regard our activity or regard work. One is give it up, karma sannyas. That's the one that Arjuna is advocating in the beginning, because he doesn't want to fight against his cousins, against his grandfather, against his revered teacher. He doesn't want to do that. It's religious. It's virtuous to have that reluctance. Bhagavad Gita class for children is a little tough. They did pretty well for the time that they sat peacefully there. But telling stories is much easier. They can pay attention and say the detail back like it's unbelievable. But Bhagavad Gita is a little tough. Sometimes for adults it's a little tough too. But we have to rise to the occasion and try to understand Bhagavad Gita's message. Wishing to be an independent enjoyer. The jiva wishing to be not jiva but purusha. Or Prabhupada says, wanting the kingdom of God without God. That's the program. Wanting the kingdom of God without God. Well, that's the kingdom of Maya. It appears that there's no God, but there is. And to have the appearance that there's no God, then it's a free-for-all. Who can become the most powerful controller? Who can be the most wealthy or the most this or that or the other thing? And you know, it's a poor imitation of the real deal, the real position of who is the controller and who is the Purusha, who is the enjoyer, who is the proprietor, who is the dearmost friend of all living entities. And two most difficult things. One is very simple, bodily conception, misidentifying the self with the covering of the self. That's like how it gets started. And then that which comes from the body is thinking that falls under the category of mind. I and mind. Two psychic divisions of material consciousness. I and mind. I am this body, and what comes from this body is mine. Work comes from this body, and so it's mine. And the fruits of the work, because it comes from this body, is mine. And things that the fruits of the work can buy, that's also mine. And then my family, my husband, wife, and children, it's mine. I got this whole mind thing going on, when it's not really who we are to start with, nor is it mine. So there's a spiritual conception of I and mine. And letting go of the material one comes first. And we can look at the flaws in it, like we're spending a little time right now, the flaws in it. But there, purification is needed. That's why we engage in the chanting of Hare Krishna, to take purification of consciousness in a very simple way. Again, this, you know, even a child can perform kirtan, and it's very nice. Chanting cleanses the heart, and the message of Bhagavad Gita helps guide our activities, specifically now for this conversation, away from fruitive activities and towards devotional activity. And the fruitive activities can become devotional activities by purified consciousness, engaging in family life, engaging in the work that supports the family and the family life. And doing all those things in the consciousness that this is Krishna's kingdom, it's his property, I'm a citizen in Krishna's kingdom, all the property is his, this house is his, the body is his, even the soul is his, and the family members are his, and everything is his. And I'm working in devotion for him. And I have a particular set of responsibilities for those who Krishna has entrusted me with. My wife or my husband and my children and my parents and my relatives and like that. But the spiritual conception is that's a temporary arrangement. I accept acting in a theistic manner according to that temporary arrangement. That's for me. It's suited for my nature. And let me keep very clear in mind the message of Bhagavad Gita. What's my place in this picture? How do I best use time? How do I best use material nature? How do I best regard other living entities? How do I best regard God? And how do I best regard my work? The activities I do in this field. Let me try my best to regard them with devotion, under the guidance of the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita. I didn't get very far in the paragraph, but the beginning stage of study of Bhagavad Gita is kind of like, you know, education for children. It's kind of information based. What this is this and that's that. You know, using the power of the intellect to discriminate one thing from another thing and get it straight. That's just beginning. That's a theoretical beginning. The message of Bhagavad Gita, however, as you live with it, and it starts to, by osmosis, it just becomes part of your being. It enters into your heart and it becomes the way in which you see things, the way in which you experience other living entities, the way in which you experience your work, the way that you experience material nature. Your whole outlook on life becomes transformed by the transcendental knowledge combined with the activities of cleansing of the heart. And so your life then becomes guided by the message of Bhagavad Gita into the realm of a life of devotion. Not that the shirt that you're wearing has to change, or the job that you're working has to change, or that, you know, you have to like throw things away and become a mendicant. That's not the message of Bhagavad Gita. Not that kind of detachment or renunciation, but renunciation of the material conception of life and live with the spiritual conception of life. That's required. Krishna wasn't asking Arjuna, you're a householder, you have to stop being a householder. You're a kshatriya, you have to stop being a kshatriya and just, you know, become a mendicant. Arjuna wanted to become a mendicant. Krishna said, no, don't become a mendicant. Stay in your position. Engage in your prescribed duty. And always think of me. So that's easier said than done. And how do you do it? So the message of Bhagavad Gita teaches. But it requires, as the introduction is presenting, a proper understanding of these five basic things. And with that proper understanding, together with a heart that becomes cleansed, and, you know, seeing examples in the world of people who do live like that, then it's not theoretical anymore. It's, oh, that's how you do it. That's the position of, for example, at our altar here, there's a picture of Bhaktivinoda Thakur in this disciplic succession. He's in the middle. He's one of our acharyas, and he was a householder with 10 children. You may have one or two to keep you busy. Yes. He had 10. 10 children. Of course, one of them happened to be a pure devotee, but he had 10 children. Who knows about the other 9? And he was a high court judge. He had a busy life, high court judge. Along with the work, he had his social obligations of meeting people, and because he was Indian born during the British rule to become a high court judge. That's like, that didn't happen. They wanted British people to, you know, that's a high position. But he was so good. They made him a high court judge. And they gave him some of the most challenging places to go and be a judge because it was so difficult. And in addition, he wrote 100 books. Ever write a book? He wrote 100 books. I mean, so, and he was a householder. So the message of Bhagavad Gita isn't stop being a householder and give up your livelihood and, you know, go join an ashram somewhere in South India. That's not the message of Bhagavad Gita. Stay in your position. Fix your consciousness upon the Supreme by methods of devotion, by the methods and the instructions given within Bhagavad Gita. So take it seriously and your life becomes spiritualized. And when your life becomes spiritualized, like this little section, the businessman thinking, oh, now I'm successful, I'm happy, and then somehow things get changed. Time turns, and that success becomes calamity, and it's all gone. then you're a sufferer because of attachment to the material conception of being the enjoyer of the configuration of matter. So that's not advised in Bhagavad Gita. So understanding each of these five, committing oneself to the path of linking with the Supreme, yoga means linking with the Supreme, given within the message of Bhagavad Gita, detachment from the material conception, attachment to the spiritual conception of how to live in this world connected to the Supreme. I've talked too much. Let's see if there's any comments or questions. Anything? You have something? No? Okay. Can I do a little editing? There's two things. There's philosophy and there's that which makes teachings and there's that which makes the heart pure. So the heart, that which makes the heart pure without being guided by proper philosophy can become sentimentalism or fanaticism, and that's a dangerous thing. And then philosophy, where the heart is not pure, leads to speculation. The tendency is there if the heart is not pure. When one comes in contact with philosophy to speculate. So speculation or philosophy without a system that also makes the heart pure is incomplete. So we want teachings to guide our lives, but we want a heart that's pure. We need both. So a spiritual teaching has both. If it has one without the other, it's incomplete. The philosophy without the means that makes the heart pure leads to speculation. And it's inconclusive. So spiritual teaching must have both. So I know your question is, how do we know if we're speculating? Well, there's class 1 speculation, class 2 speculation, class 10 speculation. There are degrees of speculative tendency. In general, speculative tendency means to try to understand things merely through our own capacities, not receiving transcendental knowledge that's descending, but trying to understand by an ascending means. Prabhupada gives the example of searching for the sun with a flashlight, or in India you call it a torch. So searching for the sun, where is the sun? And that's not how the sun is found. The sun is self-luminous and it discloses itself. You don't need a flashlight or a torch to find the sun. It's not the right means. But the tendency to take our own power and search for the truth by our own power, that's a speculative tendency. But on the other hand, we are to search for the truth, but in this descending manner. You go to Bhagavad Gita and we're searching for the truth. But now I can go to Bhagavad Gita and search for the truth by a speculative tendency. Speculative tendency in simple language is, this means that. I attended a home program in New Jersey, and there was a family, an older Bengali family, and they liked the devotees to come because they like kirtan, so they have kirtan, and you know, having a sannyasi come to their home, that was nice, and then the little class, and then prasadam, so it was nice, they liked it. But they, as an older couple, they had their older friends, and their older friends were used to something different. They were used to, this means that. They're used to hearing speculative approaches to the message of Bhagavad Gita. I mean, I very distinctly remember. So at the end, one gentleman said, could you give us different interpretations on that section that you just read? Can you entertain us with some fireworks display, please? Like, look at that one. That was good. Can you do that again? I said, we don't do that. Our message is, when Krishna says, surrender unto me, it's, the message is surrender to Krishna. That's what it means. Now, I could tell you what some commentators say, this means that. But that's not what we do. When Krishna doesn't know what he means or can't say what he means, he doesn't need our help to say, when he says this, he means that. When Krishna says this, he means this. When Krishna says that, he means that. It's very simple. So when Krishna says, surrender unto me, that's our message. Then there's ways in which we can surrender unto Krishna. So speculation is, this means that. Receiving descending knowledge with an inquisitive spirit is, we wish to understand what Krishna means, but not by speculation, but by opening the heart and descending knowledge. I'll give a little example, because we just mentioned it previously. How there's, I want to see action in inaction and action in inaction, even to say it, sounds like mumbo-jumbo. So what to speak of understanding it. And so it's a difficult subject. Krishna says it's a difficult subject. How are we going to understand that by speculative means? We're not. But by hearing in disciplic succession, then we can understand. The whole message of work in devotion is mysterious if you're not a devotee. If you haven't received bhakti, to understand work and devotion, it's a mystery. Because what does it look like? It's another species that you've never encountered before. Where you work without attachment to the fruits of your work. Who goes to the office, to an office that says, we're not going to pay you anything, but we'd like you to work. You don't have many people signing up for that job. But this is not just that kind of thing. It's the sense of proprietorship of... So how many people will go to work knowing that their employer wishes them to understand that the paycheck that they received after a certain pay period, it belongs to Krishna. Because the ability to work has come from Krishna, the intelligence to work has come from Krishna, and everything else you can think of comes from Krishna. So the paycheck is also from Krishna, for Krishna, and use it in Krishna's service. Now if you could find such an employer, fantastic. That'd be, you know, that's what the spiritual world is. Everyone's doing some activity, and it's all for the satisfaction of Krishna. And whatever comes from those activities is for the satisfaction of Krishna. But it requires a change of consciousness to see like that. And that's different than speculation. It's descending knowledge. inquisitive to know, Brahma Jigyasa, inquiring or being inquisitive to know about the spiritual reality. But that can be through descending knowledge. That's the speculative tendency, is ascending knowledge. I wish to find the sun by using my flashlight. And with descending knowledge, that there's symptoms. It's very nice. The Bhagavatam presents a verse where when one's consciousness has been touched by transcendental knowledge, there's symptoms. Devotion, the desire to serve the Supreme, awakens. Para Isha Anubhav. We've spoke about Ishwara. So Para Isha Anubhav, the feelings of attachment for the object of service, Krishna. And Viraktir Anyatra Cha, detachment from other things. That's a symptom of when speculative tendency has subsided. Feeling a desire to serve, feeling affection for the object of the person being served, the Supreme, and detachment from other things. Not just following some regulation that says don't this and don't that, but detachment from other things. Fashion and whatever, whatever. Anything else? You have something? Yeah?
Please accept my humble obeisances, Maharaj. Maharaj, you were talking about the different emanations that come from the complete whole and they remain complete. So
mm-hmm.
I was trying to understand what the different aspect, what when you say completeness, what is that you're trying to mean by completeness?
Now, what I'm trying to mean, it's what these are, the personified Vedas speaking, the Upanishads, and there's a system within each of the emanations from the Supreme Lord. There's a system, whether it's in the macro scale or the micro scale, for the maintenance of that which comes from the Supreme. Let's take a universe. That's pretty big. It's not, you know, from the picture of everything, it's not so big, but within the universe there's an arrangement for the maintenance of the whole universe. Everything it needs for its maintenance is there. The whole unit. And that unit that has a system for its maintenance, the system for its maintenance as well as the unit itself comes from the Supreme. He is complete in itself. The universe can, you know, as long as time permits, operate. And then you can take the micro scale, you know, a little microorganism or something. Or, you know, us. There's an arrangement for this life, this body, and that, you know, its needs to be taken care of. There's an arrangement by the Supreme for that. And during different phases there's different things. There's the mother while the child is within the womb, and you know, the arrangement is there by Purnam, by Om Purnam. There's the arrangement for that child that's within the womb. Anyway, without elaborating all the details. So micro or macro scale, there's an arrangement for the maintenance of all things, and that the arrangement is itself complete. When the natural order of things is observed, and when the natural order of things is ignored or broken, then there's disturbance, and then there's reaction for that disturbance, and there's, you know, life in the world, turmoil and conflict. But if we can restore, recognize that the message is of Visvapanishad is to recognize the Supreme and the arrangement of the Supreme for the preservation and maintenance of all emanations from the Supreme, live in harmony with the Supreme. Even there's arrangement for our returning to our original position within this creation. It's established by the Supreme. It's directly enacted by the Supreme, whereas the other is through his agencies of his energies. It's directly enacted by the Supreme. And so the system is complete. Suffering, the root cause of suffering is ignorance. That's another Vedic understanding. So the antidote for ignorance is knowledge, but not just theoretical knowledge, but realized knowledge. That's when we come to the stage of realization of, let's say, these five topics of Bhagavad Gita, we can live in harmony with God and with nature, and with ourselves and amongst ourselves. The arrangement is there. The opportunity is there. But when there's ignorance, I mean, you try as hard as we may to be, you know, be sincere and be good and so forth and so on, but it's still incomplete. Because of that ignorance. So becoming situated with proper understanding, that's recommended. Therefore, Bhagavad Gita is there. Dharma sangstha panartaya sambhavami yoge yoge. Krishna comes to establish that once again. When it's yoga nashta, when it's destroyed, he comes to establish it again. The proper knowledge of our relationship with the Supreme, and then the other factors, the other living entities and material nature and time, how to utilize time, how to utilize whatever it is that's given to us, the endowments that are bestowed upon us from the Supreme, how to use that. We have some faculty of intelligence. We have some different abilities, and how to use those things in such a way it's pleasing to the Supreme, and thereby the sense of detachment from being the enjoyer of those activities. But Krishna is the enjoyer of those activities, so our happiness is more complete than if we try separate happiness. The happiness of love is greater than the happiness of proprietor, you know, false proprietorship. Anything else? Okay. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.